Right, the Senate Human Services Committee will come to order. It is Monday, May 1st. Happy May Day, everyone. Excellent timing. Wow. So, I think that means I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2944.
Madam Chair, would you like me to read it or let the Speaker introduce it?
Why don't you read the summary and then we will let the Speaker speak to the bill.
House Bill 2944A requires a landlord to approve the amount of damages to be eligible for funds from the Housing Choice Landlord Guarantee Program, and those provisions become operative September 1st, 2017. It repeals the requirement for a tenant to repay the Housing Choice Landlord Guarantee Program for assistance paid to the landlord. It declares emergency and is effective on passage. There was also a -A5 amendment submitted earlier today, and it is up on OLIS. It changes the operative date to August 1st, 2017, and it clarifies that provisions apply to claims for financial assistance based on judgments entered on or after the operative date.
Thank you. Speaker Kotek.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Kimmy Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the House. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about House Bill 2944 today. Back in 2013, the legislature passed House Bill 2639, which was a bill to ban discrimination based on source of income in housing, specifically prohibiting landlords from discriminating against individuals who are paying for their housing with a Section 8 voucher or a housing choice voucher. And part of the conversations, which were quite lengthy with the landlord community at the time, was if we were going to do that, we would also set up a guarantee fund for landlords if, when and if they rented to, or when, because they couldn't no longer rent just by virtue of Section 8, but when they rented and if they had an issue, there'd be a fund for them to have to apply for funds if there was damage on their rental property. And we felt like this was a good faith effort to, you know, come up with a way to say, hey, if you have a problem, we want to, you know, back you up. It has come to our attention since then. Part of the bill also set up an advisory group that looked at, and it has improved communication between the housing authorities and the landlords and the state about the housing choice voucher program to begin with. But this advisory board has been looking at the data on the use of the fund, and it's come to our attention that the structure of the fund has been vulnerable to abuse by some landlords. Because under current law, a landlord must obtain a judgment against the tenant in small claims court. However, under the current structure, such judgments can be obtained without any evidence of wrongdoing. So a landlord could say, I have this damage, but they don't have to prove it necessarily. They just have to make the claim. So currently, if a tenant does not show up in court, which is frankly quite regular, the landlord wins by default. So over 80% of cases relating to the fund are default judgments, in part because many low-income tenants face barriers to just getting to court. So you have a landlord making a claim, not having to prove it. And what we are finding is that we have landlords, some landlords, taking advantage of the program. So as it stands, a landlord can bring a faulty claim, win on a default judgment, and claim up to $5,000 from the fund. Meanwhile, the judgment goes on the tenant's record, and they are at risk of losing their voucher. So what we have done with this bill, and it passed strongly off the House floor, is say that landlords need to come and make a little effort to make a claim and not just win by default. So they have to go before a judge to provide information on why they have the situation that they need to access the fund. And the other thing in the current law, we had required the agency to also try to retrieve some of the damage funds from some of the tenants. And while at the time that made sense, what we found is that the agency was spending a lot of money, actually $44,000 to collect $7,100 from voucher holders, it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. I just want to remind people that if you are a renter and there's a claim made against you, you know, there are a lot of other ways to be held accountable besides the agency going after trying to collect that money. So the bill that passed the House would require the landlords to actually go before a judge to make a claim and not just win by default. We removed the piece where the agency was going out after trying to collect for the fund. And again, there's other means to hold the tenant accountable, but it didn't seem to be an effective way for the agency to you know, engage with the tenants. And then you also have the -A5 in front of you that makes one technical change, but the other change, we're changing the implementation date from September 1st of 2017 on page 2, line 21 of the bill, to August 1st. And basically, we wanted to make sure that there wasn't this larger window of landlords being able to seek a judgment without having to take that claim before a judge. So it rolls it back a month to get us started a little sooner on that. So with that, I urge your support and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the speaker?
Just one. As a curiosity, you said there's other ways to collect. Could you give me an idea of what they might be?
Sure, Madam Chair and Senator Olson. So the landlord could take the tenant to court like any other, you know, so go to small claims court and go further for the damages. It shows up on the tenant's record. And if you're a Section 8 holder, in most cases, if you've really damaged a property, it would likely jeopardize your voucher as well. So there are a lot of different ways where being a problem tenant would come back to haunt you no matter what, even if the state wasn't trying to recover some of the damages. It was never the expectation that the fund would be kind of replenished by the tenants. And in fact, I think we want to make sure we have enough money in there to continue to, you know, have a backstop for the landlords, which is one of the reasons we want to make sure landlords aren't abusing it, because we have just a handful of landlords who are taking disproportionate advantage of the fund right now. Thank you, Senator.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Anybody else who would like to be heard on House Bill 2944? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2944. And I do not see our other members here yet, so we are going to move on to House Bill 2315. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2315.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2315 permits a lender financing affordable housing.
please hold. All right. Pause. We're going to push the pause button.
All right.
All right. We're going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 2315 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3175. Sorry about that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3175 modifies the definition for low-income households to include income levels for households renting and households owning rental housing in a local innovation and fast-track housing program. It declares emergency and is effective on passage.
Thank you. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For your record, I am David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon Coast. We appreciate your courtesy and jumbling your schedule a little bit so we can share some ideas with you and then run back to other committees. So, Madam Chair, 3175 is one of four bills that is being presented this session, co-sponsored by Senator Johnson, by Representative Witt, by Representative Wisnett, and myself, all with the intention of assisting with home building or home support programs, whether it help nonprofit groups acquire property or help low-income people who own their homes stay in those homes in the face of unexpected expenses, or in the case of 3175 that's before you here today, making changes in current rules. Just very, very briefly, because I know you're familiar with the background on these kinds of issues, the challenges that we face providing affordable housing for Oregon's population around the state. But I just wanted to get into your record that this is a challenge for people that want to live and work in Oregon. It's also a challenge for people that want to hire those employees. In my own district out on the coast, we see help wanted signs everywhere. And one of the major impediments to finding qualified employees is the fact that folks that work at the coast can't afford to live at the coast. So this is a community-wide problem that affects all aspects of the community and the economy that works within that community. And that's one of the reasons that we feel so strongly about these supportive programs for home ownership and first-time home buyers. House Bill 3175 will expand the successful LIFT housing program. A LIFT gives a little extra boost to Oregonians who are just short of being able to afford a home of their own. Owning your own home, again, as I just said, improves the health, the wealth, and the family stability. It improves community stability as well, since homeowners stay longer and build connections with their neighbors. This bill clarifies that Oregonians who make up to 80% of the area median income qualify for home ownership loan assistance through LIFT. Now, there will be some other people that are going to be testifying in this today during your hearing. I just wanted to give it a quick introduction. My wingman today, Representative Wisnett, said he wanted to come down because the committee needed to see somebody better looking than myself to support this bill. That's what he said to me this morning.
And more senior.
You actually have a striking resemblance to one another when you're sitting there like that.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair, and Honorable Committee members, For the record, I'm Gene Wisnett, the State Representative, House District 53. It's an honor to be here. Representative Gomberg asked me to join him because we've worked several bills together for Habitat for Humanity, and so I'm glad to join him on this bill of sponsoring. I think it will help, as he said. It not only helps affordable renting houses, but also purchasing houses, which he talked about. So I think it's a good bill, passed through the House easily, and we hope that this committee will start its on its way to through the Senate and help affordable housing issues. Senator Knope and I probably have as big an issue as he that Representative Gomberg does on the coast and even Multnomah County, because we have a lot of service people too in Central Oregon. So I think this may help that issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for these representatives before we let them head back to their committees? Of course you do, Senator Olson.
Of course I always do. I was just wondering when the House is going to start sending some bills over that will help the cost of lots, the cost of building lots, and the cost of land, so that affordable houses can be built.
A challenging problem, of course, Senator, and land, particularly in my district, is an issue constrained by urban growth boundaries on one side and by the tsunami regulatory line on the other side. We're facing a particular problem at the coast as that line is adjusted. And if the state says that you can't build essential structures such as schools or fire departments or hospitals, how on earth are we going to convince people to buy houses in those same areas? And if they can buy those houses there, how are they going to get insurance for them? So we are indeed facing a number of long-term problems with the cost of land, and I don't have any quick and easy answers for you, quite candidly.
Madam Chair, Co-Chair, Senator Knope and I introduced a bill in the House, had one hearing and died, addressing regional land use. It was modeled after what Governor Kitzhaber did in Jackson, Douglas, and Josephine County to allow them to look at regionalized land use. I talked to a friend of mine at church. Vacant lots for Habitat for Humanity in South County, South Deschutes County, are 40,000, so it is an issue.
I thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to put that on the record so that both the House and the Senate understand that our land use problems are problems for everybody.
Well, Senator, I'll just add that I believe one of the pieces of legislation we're bringing forward this session also helps organizations like Habitat acquire land when there are opportunities and hold that land for the future to build on, rather than being constrained by how long they can hold the property. One of the issues that they deal with is the fact that when they acquire land, they've got to pay property taxes on it, of course, and that makes it more difficult for financially stretched nonprofits to acquire and hold property. So we have tried to address that, but again, that's narrowly focused on organizations like Habitat and similar groups, not addressing the broader question that you addressed here today.
Madam Chair, maybe we could advance that a little bit, because the way my construction business is going, I'm nonprofit also.
So. All right, any further questions for this panel?
Thank you so much.
Very much. It's good to see you both. All right, next we have Diane Lynn, Karen Rockwell, and Shannon Villier.
Good afternoon, and thank you so much for having us here today. My name is Diane Lynn. I'm Executive Director of Proud Ground. We're a community land trust-based model organization with a sole purpose of promoting affordable home ownership for working families, and we're working now more broadly around the state with different organizations in very close partnership with Habitat. So the points we would like I would like to share this afternoon with all of you about this bill, House Bill 3175, is that it's really important to increase the MFI reach of this bill. Most of you are pretty familiar with the LIFT program. The first rollout was last year. We're really looking for more of a focus on homeownership for all the reasons our research, and you will hear from a lot of people about the impacts. This is one of our studies about the impacts on children and community and on stability. It's a final solution as it relates to housing for families. And we are of the belief among our partners that we can actually use these resources and leverage them with other state and federal resources and local support to create more homeownership opportunities. What we do is we bring a conventional mortgage to the table in the case of Proud Ground families, and we focus mostly on 60 to 80% of median income. So they've actually earned their own mortgage. It's just not at the level that the market demands. It's at a level they can actually afford no more than 38% of their income, so their family can thrive. We avoid private mortgage insurance, and we are very exacting about the affordability calculations to make it truly affordable so the family can do well. This type of bill really also addresses the need for inventory around the state. You're all going to hear about the crunch in the communities all around Oregon around just not having enough houses, or they're becoming older and older over time, and we need some new homes. I've been working recently with Lincoln County, David Gomberg's district, around home ownership opportunities there. Commissioner Bill Hall has invited us down to help manage their community land trust. There's no doubt that 60% of median income in a place like Lincoln County is just so very low that the resources really can't be leveraged effectively. That's why this increase, it's kind of a technical increase, from 60 to 80% of median income, so very important for those kinds of communities around the state. We are, again, making real efforts to creatively leverage some donated land, as you were just chatting about, and the local excise tax that was made possible last session, and other resources we find. I want to end my testimony by emphasizing the critical need to really start to make progress on ending the minority homeownership gap that's been so prevalent here in the state of Oregon. Half of our own homeowners in the Portland metropolitan area are people of color. We've been very effective at serving them. 68% of the people on our wait list have people of color in their households. We're partnering with community-specific agencies to do that work, and that's when real justice in the housing challenge and crisis comes to the forefront. Again, we're extremely proud to be partners with Habitat for Humanity, both statewide and locally, to leverage all the assets we all bring to serve as many working families as we possibly can to start to turn this tide. So thank you for your support for this very important bill.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hello, I'm Karen Rockwell. I'm the executive director of Benton Habitat for Humanity, located in Corvallis, Oregon. I really appreciate...
Hey.
I know, yay! appreciate you giving me the opportunity today to speak in support of HB 3175. Briefly, Benton Habitat for Humanity has been building homes since 1991, and we currently have over 200 people that live in Habitat homes throughout Benton County. Primarily, our homes are built in Corvallis, Philomath, and Alsea, so we're about half urban and half... Corvallis considers itself urban, and half half rural. The need in our area is extremely critical. We have very low vacancy rates. We're extraordinarily high land costs are pricing us out of the market, and the lack of available land is a big issue in our area. This bill has some strengths that are very, very attractive. One is the land trust model. That takes the cost out of the equation for individuals that are seeking to have home ownership opportunities. In Corvallis, we've successfully used this tool. We have our own land trust that has four homes on it, and we anticipate continuing this process as we move forward because it allows us to have that home stay forever part of the affordable housing stock. And then it also, like I said, it takes the land cost out of the equation for a family. So historically, we're serving between 25 and 60% of the area median income, and that isn't enough to purchase a home. So if we take the land cost out of it, we can control the mortgage for our families, keep it to 30% of their median income. And our families, the ones that we have in our land trust, they're service workers, they're retail workers, they are educators, they're individuals that are a part of our working community, but they are not able to get the homes. In addition, having this tool in place is going to be a great tool in our toolbox to continue affordable home building and in meeting the crisis in our community. Right now, we're primarily one of the only home ownership builders, and we've built approximately 38 homes. It's not enough to meet the now rising need, so we need additional tools to become more reactive in this marketplace. Another thing I just wanted to iterate is the greatest need in housing in Corvallis is for affordable housing for both renters and owners. Census and HUD data demonstrate that housing cost burden, paying more than 30% of income for housing costs, and severe housing cost burden, paying more than 50%, are the city's most frequent and significant housing problems, and that's according to the city's consolidated plan. So it really is a need. I do urge you all to move this forward, and I thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. My name is Shannon Billhauer. I'm the Executive Director of Habitat for Humanity of Oregon. Madam Chair, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, thank you for the chance to testify in support of House Bill 3175. This bill is really part of the efforts of a home ownership joint work group that's co-supported by the Housing Alliance and Oregon Opportunity Network. It's sort of a new idea because, quite honestly, the state of Oregon, this will be the first time that we're investing in affordable home ownership development. So we have quite a few tools that are already out there for multifamily rental housing development, but we've been working on proceeds from our restores, any federal funding we can bring to our state, individuals' charitable donations to help us house for Habitat for Humanity statewide, the first 1,400 Oregon families. And if we just keep pace with what we're doing, we're on track to serve 150 in the next biennium. We want to double that. There's so much need. And one thing that I think has really come to light as our work group has partnered together for about the last 18 months leading up to this session is that we understand that homeowners of all incomes, if they have access to an appropriate tool, can be successful. Right, so 98% of our Habitat for Humanity homeowners pay their mortgage off, right? So, and that's when our average AMI that we serve statewide is 39%, or for a four-person household in the Willamette Valley here, that's $22,000 a year, right? They make their mortgage payments, and their kids don't have to change schools when the rent goes up. They get to stay in the same place, and we just did a statewide impact study with the help of Children First for Oregon, and we can document that 92% of the kids who grow up in our Habitat for Humanity homes are graduating from high school. Yes. So, you know, we talk about working upstream. You know, this is it. And these homes are going to remain permanently affordable. So we're incredibly grateful to be here speaking with you today. And we've been working right along the line with Oregon Housing and Community Services because we want to be ready to go when LIFT funds become available. So thank you for this opportunity. And I'm happy to address any sort of technical questions about the bill.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for this panel? Senator Dimbrough.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I very much support this effort to extend the program to include people who need workforce housing. And is there any concern, though, of people at the lower end of the spectrum being pushed out as a result of that? Is that something that you considered?
Let me take this on. And thank you for emphasizing the permanent affordability component of this. Community land trust homes, and the plan is to partner with the state to establish that equity interest the state requires through the bond, Q-bond, use of the Q-bonds. In doing so, there's an absolute promise assurance that every time that home is resold, it's resold within the range that we've committed to and no higher. And to do that, we start at the lowest end of those of the spectrum for Habitat homes, the low end of the 30 to 40% for Proud Ground families with a conventional mortgage between our targets around 65% of median income, which, by the way, in the state of Oregon, 60% of the jobs that have been created here have been at 60% of median income. That's what people are actually making. So it's a better target anyway, and then it gives us room to grow. You forego the actual value of the house increase over time, and you stick to the deed restriction that that focuses on being sure the next income qualified family can purchase that home. The homes we're talking about here will never be sold at market value.
And if I may as well, for Habitat for Humanity, I like to look at these trends of who we're able to serve. And as land prices have been more expensive, as the construction industry is picking up and it's more expensive to work with subcontractors, it's harder for them to be able to donate because they have paying jobs lined up. Our prices are going up. And so up until now, our average AMI served has been 39%. When I look ahead to the next 18 months, I'm seeing 46.5%. So that's a little bit of an upward tick. For Habitat for Humanity, at least, a tool like the land trust model enables us to go back to serving those 30% AMI families because the price of the land is taken out of the mortgage calculation.
I have a question.
Senator Olson.
When these folks purchase these homes and you say they don't appreciate, so they don't get any equity out of them when they sell them?
Well, it's a very fair question. Our master lease is based on a resale formula that allows a working family to bring as little as $500 to the table. This is, again, for the 60 to 80% MFI family. As low as $500, a few thousand for closing costs usually. They get the loan or grant that comes to the table is their down payment. It buys the land. And then we can ensure that when they resell, they get every penny they put into their payments for on principal back out again, down payment, any large improvements they made, and 25% of the increased value of that home based on appraisals from the moment they purchased originally to the moment they sell. And that way, they really do gain equity over time, which is very important as it relates to the minority home ownership gap. And we've actually studied this with Eco Northwest to see how much money people were able to generate, and it's been around $60,000 in 10 years' time. So for a working family to be able to sell their home and make $60,000 and have had a very affordable, we're talking about $1,000 a month mortgage payment, which is, in this day and age, better than rent, it really gives them an opportunity to thrive and grow, and then the next income qualified family can still afford that home within the margins.
I'm glad you clarified that, because it would be kind of a deficit if they got in the house, lived there for 10 years, and walked out with nothing. But I'm glad to see that they actually have some equity that they can move up into a bigger place or whatever.
That's just about enough to take it out to the market and be able to use that as a down payment on a home they earn full equity in. And they could then be a part of the American dream that so many people have been able to appreciate.
Any further questions?
I will just say that I've built several Habitat houses in Canby. I shouldn't say I've built them. I've worked on them.
Thank you.
I've helped.
Do you have the hammer in hand?
Yeah. Right.
Thank you all very much. This is really
so
exciting.
Much. Thank
very,
you.
Very, very exciting. You. So is there anybody else that would like to be heard on this bill? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3175 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2315.
All right.
Thank you for your patience.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2315 permits lender financing affordable housing to receive tenant housing vouchers when claiming the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. It applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2018, and it takes effect the 91st day following signing die.
Welcome.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margaret Salazar, and I'm Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. We're here today to talk about the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, or OAHTC. This program has been a vital tool to help produce affordable housing throughout the state. And in fact, it's only one of only two dedicated state resources for affordable housing in Oregon. To date, the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit has helped to finance more than 337 affordable properties and has created homes for more than 11,000 households and families across Oregon. In addition to allocating this resource, our agency, OHCS, is also responsible for compliance. We monitor the properties that receive Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credits to ensure that the property owners are complying with the program. And today we are here to discuss our agency bill, which proposes a technical fix to the program program to allow our agency to better oversee these properties. With me today are two members of our team, Ariel Nelson and Teresa Pumala. They're the experts on the program, so I'll hand it over to them to talk a little bit more about our agency bill.
Thanks. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Ariel Nelson. I'm the Government Relations and Communications Liaison at Oregon Housing and Community Services. Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee, as Margaret shared, House Bill 2315 makes a technical fix to the compliance end of the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. This is a piece of statutory cleanup legislation that the agency has been waiting to submit since 2015 when we created an administrative rule that really gets specific on that compliance end of the tax credit. To back up with a little bit of background, the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit provides a state tax credit to mortgage lenders, and they reduce the interest rates on loans used for the development or rehabilitation of affordable housing. And affordable housing developers then receive that reduced mortgage interest rate. And in return, they're required to pass through that savings to their tenants in the form of a discounted rent. So this is a tax credit that actually directly benefits the tenants in these properties. The affordable housing projects that benefit from the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit have to demonstrate that dollar for dollar, what we call a pass-through, to the tenants. And that can be calculated in a variety of ways. But every year, those properties have to certify with the agency and show the calculations for that pass-through and show that they really are passing that on to their tenants. In 2015, OHCS adopted an administrative rule that got really specific on how we want property owners and managers to calculate that pass-through when they have tenants in the units that have housing choice tenant-based vouchers. Those go with a tenant from unit to unit. They follow the tenant. The administrative rule is submitted on OLIS for your reference, as well as our one-pager that gets really specific on these calculations can get really complicated depending on how long the loan is and that kind of a thing. But just a high-level overview, the administrative rule gets very specific, and House Bill 2315 just further codifies that rule. On the top of page 3 of the bill, it removes the language, regardless of other subsidies, from the statute. And that's to recognize those situations where OHTC properties need to account for units with tenant vouchers. So, in short, the bill gives the agency additional flexibility to specify in rule how we want that pass-through to be calculated for those units with tenant-based vouchers. It just further strengthens and makes sure that we're monitoring this really efficient, important state tool for our affordable housing developments. We also have Teresa Paloma here, who is our tax credit manager. If anyone has those specific questions, she really is the expert on this issue.
Right. Thank you so much. Do we have any questions for this panel? Senator Dembrough.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So what has been the value of the pass-through, you know, in terms of, you know, the amount of money that has flowed to be used by low-income tenants?
On average, Teresa Pumala, Tax Credit Program Manager, OHCS. On average, we see about between $40 and $50 a month in reduction in rent to tenants with the OHTC pass-through. Are you looking for more of a...
I'm actually interested in a global number to know what the state is investing in the program.
Okay. So generally, our current cap is at $17 million worth of credits, and those credits are directly correlated to the interest rate reduction that has to be there. And in general, with two exceptions, that all has to be passed through the tenant. The exceptions we have are for preservation projects, and that's for projects that have at least 25% of project-based vouchers existing that are at risk of loss for those project-based vouchers from HUD and RD, and then, of course, the preservation of manufactured home parks. Neither of those have to demonstrate the pass-through to the tenants. But other than that, dollar for dollar, everything else gets passed through.
Mm-hmm. And just one last follow-up. And the cap, has it been, you know, how close are we getting to the cap? Is it fully used?
Yes, as much as we put out is where it gets fully used. There is currently an approach that we're looking at, a different administrative approach to how to utilize the cap. It gets kind of complicated, but it comes down to the amortization schedules and everything of the loans that we have in our pipeline. So we currently, I think, if with the new administrative approach, we may only be at around 11 to 12 million of our cap. If we're looking at the new way of approaching the annual $17 million cap, but that's only limited by the fact that our past approach kept us from putting out more available. Right now, if I were to make the additional available, it would most likely be gone within 30 days.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you all so much. We really appreciate it and really appreciated your coming around ahead of time so that we could each visit with you and learn about the bill. Is there anybody else that wants to be heard on House Bill 2315? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2315 and open up a work session on House Bill 3160. We're about to lose Senator Olson. So this is the white cane bill that we heard last week with Representative Cowan, with Senator Olson's emergency clause, which I understand he moved again in another bill last week as well. You're a walking emergency.
Well, when you see it, you do it. Chair Gilster, I move to adopt the -A2 amendment dated 4/26/17.
Senator Olson moves to adopt the -A2 amendments dated 4/26/17. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Chair Gilster, I move House Bill 3160A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves House Bill 3160A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, Senator Knope is excused, but on your way out the door, will you see if he's standing out there?
Sure.
And send him in just so he can
see
what he's
doing. Sure, I'll carry it if you want.
And Senator Olson will carry it. And let's just sit here for a second before I close the work session to see if Senator Knope is there, because this is the last thing that we need to do. So while we're waiting,
He said he's not there.
All right. So we'll mark Senator Knope excused. Wednesday, assuming that we're off the floor on time, let's try to start as close to 1 as we can. We have House Bill 2004 scheduled. I know that it is a bill that has generated a lot of interest. So I expect that we will have a number of visitors to the committee, and the hope is to have a chance to hear where the bill is and launch the discussion about how the Senate can work to help ensure that we address the real crisis that is facing renters in Oregon. So I'm looking forward to having the bill, and have enjoyed conversations with senators, and am feeling very confident that we will be moving forward with something that's very meaningful to tenants. Any questions, concerns? Any Senator Knope?
You have to close your work session.
Yeah, I was just waiting. As soon as I drop the gavel, he's going to walk in. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3160A, and we're adjourned. 60A, and we're adjourned. 3160.